Good evening, I'm David Harris, and I'm here to do a talk on Antarctica. Just a few introductory things. Anyone know Kirk Salveson or Jeff Otten? All right, well, those two both went from Holden directly to Antarctica and sort of paved the way, and I followed them last season and went from here down to Antarctica last September as an electrician working for Antarctic Support Associates. Now there's some materials up here if you're interested, like this one, the participant guide. Antarctic Support Associates is the contractor for the National Science Foundation, which runs the Antarctic Program. And what the Antarctic Program is a research program. It's the United States research program down in Antarctica in three places. The place that I went to is at McMurdo Station, right here on the island, on Ross Island, and there's a blow-up of that area right here at the tip of Ross Island. This is actually satellite imagery, so it shows you what it looks like in the air. South Pole Station is the other one, and then Palmer Station is out, it's right here on the Antarctic Peninsula. And just to give you some perspective, South America comes down right here, and New Zealand is right about here. And so all of our support comes out of Christchurch on the South Island of New Zealand through plane flights into here. There's about 900 to 1,000 people during the summer, about 135 during the winter here at McMurdo. It's the main jumping off place for the South. Everything that goes to the South Pole goes through here, plus all the field stations that open up during the summer. There's one at Cycle Dome here. There's one at Downstream Bravo, which is right there. It's one of the glaciers that's surging right now into the Ross Ice Shelf off of West Antarctica. There are the dry valleys over in the Royal Society Range, actually right in here. There's stuff all over the place. Anyway, the National Science Foundation is running, it's purely scientific research. That's the only reason that we're down here. There used to be Navy involved in running these stations, and the Navy, as of last year, that was their last year, so they're now pulled out. Everything's been changed over to private contractors, to run these stations. The only military influence now is through the Air National Guard, which flies in from Christchurch, so they'll be running all the flights back and forth. Even the helicopters are a private contractor, PHI, Petroleum Helicopters Incorporated. Now, a closer look at the area. Well, first of all, I should say, in orienting yourself to Antarctica, this is how you usually see it. It's because longitude 0 degrees through Greenwich, England, goes through here. They picked that as the sort of north of Antarctica, because everything is north, really, from the South Pole. So you've got you have to have a convention for that. So they used 0 degrees in north. Everything over here is western Antarctica. Everything over here is eastern Antarctica. And just to give you an idea of some of the geography, this area right here, the Argus Dome, is 4,000 meters above sea level, which is very, very high height. South Pole Station is around 10,000 feet. That's 4,000 meters. About 13,000? Yeah. Okay.
Dave, when you said everything went through McMurdo, was that
supplies
strictly American?
No. In fact, McMurdo was a really, cosmopolitan, very international outfit. Here's a closer look at Ross Island, which now what we've done is we've taken this aspect, which looking towards New Zealand, we flipped it around 180 degrees, so now New Zealand is up this way. Just to give you an idea, now you've got the Trans-Antarctic Mountains coming down through here, and then they end up going out now you can see it on here. The Trans-Antarctics start right here, they go along through here, and then end up going out the peninsula. So There are two stations on Ross Island. First of all, Ross Island was formed by Mount Erebus. You've probably heard of Erebus, and that's this active volcano. It's still active. And then you've got Terra Nova and Mount Terror, which are two inactive volcanoes which complete the island. And there's this peninsula that comes off to the south where McMurdo Station and Scott Base, which is the New Zealand station, are located only a couple miles from each other out on this peninsula. And then you look across the Ross Sea, and you've got the transantarctics that go from 0 to 14,000 feet up here at, I'm forgetting my name's already. I love the name of this, Salient Peak. It's a great name. And actually, Mount Lister is the highest, but 14,000 feet from there to there, which is a pretty good chunk of real estate. And these are just incredible mountains when viewed from here, and you'll see in the pictures. But then to the looking, so when you're in McMurdo, basically what you're looking at is the Royal Society's here, and then looking south towards White Island and Black Island, and you'll see a couple pictures of that. And what's interesting is White Island is covered with snow, Black Island is completely bare of snow. And they're right next to each other.
Isn't that looking north now?
Yeah, well, actually, we're looking towards, on the other map, it would have been looking up. But think of it as looking towards the South Pole now. So this, we're looking towards the South Pole down that way. And this is where all the storms come through, is right over Minna Bluffs and through here. So when Minna Bluffs disappear, it's time to get home, because it can be anywhere from 15 minutes to a half an hour after these disappear and you're in a whiteout. But anyway, what was interesting about these is that the snow not only doesn't stay on Black Island, and it snowed a lot. Black Island would get white, and then a few days later you'd see it all disappear again. There's probably a lot of geothermal activity here, but there's also lakes that, even though it's mostly 22 to 26 degrees during the summer season, these lakes all melt. And there's algae in those lakes, one of the few native living species in this area. The dry valleys over here, you'll notice these are all free of snow. There's less than a half an inch of precip a year in these areas. It's the driest continent on Earth. And a lot of research is going on here because the ecologies are so simple. They can actually understand them. You've got these little nematodes and the biggest thing is a little sow bug-like thing that lives in the interstitiaries of the rock. And then along these lake margins, you get the lakes melting back, and you get algal growth and such in there. But anyway, and then glaciers up the wazoo. Glaciers everywhere. They're incredible. But I could go on and on. What I need to do is get to the slides, because we don't have that much time.
One question on your lower part. Is that darkest area, is that...
This is all permanent ice.
That is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the way it works, the Ross Ice Shelf, everything from here down is permanent ice. And everything from here up is annual ice. And it'll freeze all the way up there. And the annual sea ice usually comes back to right in anywhere from here to somewhere in here. And they almost always have to break the ice out to get to McMurdo for ship resupply. But the actual ridge The farthest that it melts back is all the way to here. And that's one reason why Robert Scott chose this area, is because it's the farthest south that he could sail and find. He actually found bare ground to set up Discovery Hut. Now, Discovery Hut is just a small supply hut down here on Hut Point Peninsula. Their main hut was actually back here at Cape Evans, and they set up a hut where they stayed year-round and did lots of research and such. Anyway, but this is the jumping off spot for the South Pole, and it was the place that Robert Scott was trying to get back to before he perished, 11 miles away from here. And during last summer...
When was that?
That was in 1911. Both Amundsen and Scott. Amundsen made it there a month before Scott did to the South Pole. Amundsen made it there in October or November? I guess it was November. And Scott made it there late December. So don't quote me on those. It's going to be within a half a month in there. But anyway.
And Amundsen made it back, but Scott didn't.
And Amundsen made it back. And Amundsen chose a route over here on the ice shelf that was just a straight, he got up to the ice edge and it was just straight shot over the sea ice, skiing mostly, and skiing and sled dogs, and then going up a glacier to the polar plateau and then back. It was longer, but it was easier going. And much faster on the skis and the sled dogs. Robert Scott actually manhauled all their sleds. Imagine these big, huge sledges behind you, and they were just post-holing the whole way. All you snowboarders, you post-hole up to Copper Basin. I mean, that's what they did. They post-holed 800 miles to the South Pole and back, carrying rock samples because they're very scientific. I mean, they did an incredible amount of science here, whereas Amundsen was basically, go to the pole, get out of there, we're done. And Robert, they used to say, if you wanted to go fast, you went with Amundsen. If you wanted to do science, you went with Scott. If you were in a bind and got into a real messy situation, you wanted to be with Shackleton, because Shackleton could get you out alive. And in fact, that's what he did. But that's another story. So, moving right along. So anyway, I signed up as an electrician doing mostly, I took care of their fire alarms is what I did for 5 months from October 1st through February 23rd. Okay, so I'm gonna hit all those lights over there. Whoa. There we go. Okay, so you fly in to Christchurch, big long 24-hour flight across the Pacific. You get to the clothing distribution center and they provide all of your Antarctic gear, your cold weather gear, from socks to long underwear to parkas to bib overalls. And you go through the talk, and then you take the little shuttle bus out to the tarmac, where you see the biggest airplane in the world, which is a C-5 Galaxy supply plane. And this plane only made one flight, but in its belly had a couple of snowcats, a helicopter, a front-end loader, and various... These are things that they needed before the ships could get in. Normally, they'd throw that stuff down on the ship. But anyway, so we all marched up the gangplank, and this is what it looked like, sort of, inside. And it was actually, we were all facing towards the rear of the plane, above the cargo hold, in the best airplane seats I've ever ridden in my life. They were first-class seats, and I got one of the four window seats, which meant that I got to look out on the right side, the mountainside, on our way down, which was really cool. So we're leaving South Island. All of a sudden, you see the pancake ice in the South Sea, and pretty soon you see mountains popping up, so you know you're on continent. And then the mountains get bigger, and you get glaciers in the mountains. And pretty soon, you land and you're at McMurdo Sound, and everybody's just going crazy because these are first-timers, and we're like, we're all high-fiving, we made it to Antarctica. The nose opens up, you walk out, and it's, you know, you've gone from 80 degrees in Christchurch to about 20 below here. And
how long is the flight?
The flight down, actually the C-5 was only 5 hours. On the slower turboprop LC-130s, which you'll see later, it took 8 hours. So there, you can see the Antarctic mountain. That was the first thing I noticed, was those huge, beautiful mountains in the background. And then, and this is out at the airport. From the airport, we took this ride, and we're all on annual sea ice. And they've got three airports, actually. The first airport is on the annual ice. It's called the Ice Runway, which you can land wheeled jet airplanes, the big planes for supplies, because ice doesn't give. The permanent runway, which is out at Willie Field, is on 200 feet of compact snow, and you need skis to land on that. So I should back up. Right here, you can barely see, this is all town right in here. So we're going in and then taking a dog leg into town. There's a radar dome. That's Mount Erebus up there. And this is up from Ob Hill. looking down on McMurdo Sound, you can see it's really a small town. I mean, this is Hut Point Peninsula. Discovery Hut is out here. There's a Discovery Bay where the ship Discovery anchored, and that's where they offloaded all their stuff and built Discovery Hut. You've got all the dormitories lined up here. Crary Lab, which is right here, one of the finest research facilities of its kind in the world. And they had people from all over the world coming in to do research at this place. So we had French, Belgians, Germans, Italians. The Italians, in fact, were a big part of the geologic crew that did the Cape Roberts research up there, up the Transarctics away. And then you've got these huge fuel tanks, because everything down there runs on fuel. You've got the mess hall, which is right, the galley, which is right here, and the heavy shop, the garage, where I almost work, is up there, and then all kinds of other stuff. But anyway.
May I ask for a question?
Yeah, sure. Ask a question anytime.
You know, from time to time, I've been reading for years and years and years about all these scientists down there.
Mm-hmm.
What's the main thrust? What are we looking for?
Good question. And I'll actually, can I wait to answer that? Because there's
sure,
a section in here that'll talk about that. Now, that last picture was taken from up here. I'm 180 degrees around, almost up on Arrival Heights, looking back, and you can see these are the dormitories. My dorm was actually that one right there. Everybody lives in dorms. There's two to a room. The only person that doesn't have two to a room is the ASA administrator and the National Science Foundation administrator. Those are the only two that get their own private
room. Are there families there, Dave?
There were actually, but the families in that they were all came separately. The children were in their 18 to 22 range. But yeah, they had husband, wife, and a kid that all worked down there. And the husband and wife usually were the ones that went down first, and then the kids came later. This is looking across at the Transantarctics. Another view very similar to that. This would be looking west, and then we're going to pan to the left or south.
What time of year is that?
This right here, it's going to change because I tried to keep them in the order, but this time of year was still early in the season, about November.
That's their summer, right?
Which is the beginning of their summer. It's the spring, really. Summer doesn't start until the end of December. I mean, summer down there is really like middle December through the end of January, and that's really summer. There's Discovery Hut in the foreground with Vince's cross, one of the people that died there. They erected a cross for him.
What exactly is Discovery Hut?
Discovery Hut was built by
Robert. A building?
It's a building, and I'll show it. I've got pictures of the inside and stuff later. It was a hut actually based on the Australian Outback stations, which if you know anything about that, they're these tin roof buildings that come down with the hip roofs. And it turned out that it was the completely wrong design, because those were designed to stay as cool as possible in the desert. Anyway,
who built it?
What?
Scott built it.
Robert Scott built the hut. And many, many explorers used that hut in subsequent years. So it was used. And then there's a historical society that has taken on the care of those huts and does a good job of curating them. And so you need to have special permission to go in. And they preserved everything pretty much the way it was left. And the cold, in fact, this cold, dry climate, driest in the earth, actually will preserve, like there was a penguin that was still lying on the table that hadn't decayed. That they were studying in Robert and the Evans, what do they call it? The Scott Hut up on Evans Point. And there's also a seal outside the Discovery Hut that still looked like a seal that they'd left there for the last 70 years. This is Mount Discovery across the bay. The reason I like this because it reminded me of Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm.
Made me feel like back home. Now, stepping out from the dormitories, looking out towards Mount Discovery in the background there. This is kind of the open parking area. This is where we threw the Frisbee when it got up above 32 and had our t-shirts. And you can see right there in the background the Chapel of the Snows. Mm-hmm. They built that from spare materials that were down there already that weren't earmarked for anything, and it's one of the nicest buildings there. But they have a Catholic and a Protestant service every Sunday. This is looking up. That last picture was taken right here. Now I'm down here looking up. The galley is on the right here. Here's some more dormitories. That's a cold storage warehouse. In the summertime, they had to turn on the freezer units to keep the deep freeze down at 10 degrees, because of course it got up above 10. And then right there, all these trucks are lined up on the plug-in line. There's extension cords that you plug in all the vehicles so that they start up in the morning. This is my dormitory room, and they're smaller than they are here, but there's two closets here, and I had that back half, and you can't really see much, but it's suffice it to say it's small. Anyway, this is looking out at the old water treatment plant and the old nuclear power plant. There was a nuclear power plant up on the top of the hill. You can see where the pipes ran to the old water treatment plant and back. And then, of course, storage for any number of stuff. Some of these shots I took just to show the different kind of weather and clouds that would happen down there. Just incredibly diverse weather. And, of course, it had just snowed before this, so you can see all the roofs have a dusting. And this snow actually came later on in the season. You can see there's open water. So this was in February.
Why did they discontinue the nuclear power plant?
Well, for obvious reasons. It was sort of the idea of having a nuclear power plant on what was supposed to be a pristine continent, and the Antarctic Treaty Organization states one of the things in the treaty is that you won't pollute the continent. So we kind of cleaned up our act and then told everybody, okay, we got to keep it clean down here.
Well, but they still bring coal and fuel in, you say?
They bring in diesel fuel, yeah. But everything, every spill, the snow, is scooped up and either melted and separated or shipped back home in a barrel. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes down to any spill, any antifreeze, whatever. That stuff gets picked up and carted out of there. Mm-hmm. All solid waste is completely and totally removed. It goes to Seattle for separation because we recycle. You think we have it bad here. They had like 16 different bins you could put stuff in. There's Mount Discovery again. You can see there's the generator plant. You can see three of the six generators are going. Our Cat V16s, 300 kilowatts apiece for all you techno geeks. And one of the things they're working on is recovering some of the heat that's going up the stack there and using it. They figure they can heat all the dorms just from the waste heat from these. Why it took them this long to figure that out, I don't know. But anyway, there's a closer shot. And for all you hydro fans, this is the control panel. This is the water inlet. Freshwater inlet, all those seals sitting around there by the freshwater, by the seawater inlet for our freshwater. Then you go into the water plant and you've got these ceramic reverse osmosis tubes. In the foreground, there's a big electric motor and a pump, which pumps that up to 20,000 PSI to run that thing. So they can make as much fresh water as they need directly from the seawater. And these are becoming really big now. Saudi Arabia, for instance, in the Middle East, has just got these things up the wazoo. And they've really perfected the technology now so that the cost is coming down. And they used to flash evaporate everything. They flash evaporate in a big boiler and then condense the steam for fresh water. Mm-hmm. Extremely fuel intensive, so that they're real highly water conserving during that time. This is another unit. You can see the five pistons there in that unit. That's where the pressure's created.
So they're pretty free with water now?
They're still conserving it because, I mean, it takes electricity to run it and stuff, but it's not as bad. These are the reservoirs and the chlorinating facilities are in the middle. They did have to chlorinate it, but it was very tasteless because you'd filter basically all the trace elements and everything out of it, because you're filtering down to molecular level. Mm. For all you plumbers, all the plumbing was above ground in these what looked like culverts. You notice the bands on there. Each section of culvert had solid foam insulation around a piece of bond strand pipe, which is just basically like fiberglass and resin pipe. And then six holes around that pipe for heat trace or heat tape to go around the pipe. And it's very important to make sure that all the heat traces were monitored so that you'd know when one went out. But that's how you kept all the water and sewage from freezing. This is the sewage plant, which is really just a macerator, which grinds it up, and then it just gets dumped right out there in the bay. And it's actually not as bad as you think, because it's mainly just human waste and kitchen waste, which is all organic, and they're monitoring the outflow area, and the sea life doesn't seem to be too affected other than right there.
Dave, do they melt snow for water at all?
In the field camps they do. Like out of in the remote field camps, they have their stoves. They bring in chunks of ice if they can find it, or snow, and melt it for fresh water. This is Scott Base, which is 2 miles away. You can see all the Weddell seals. They were some of the first wildlife I saw there. And you can walk right up to them. The wildlife is just, there's no Eskimos, no native populations here, so they don't know what it's like to be afraid of humans. But the Antarctic Treaty says that you will not do anything to cause them to deviate from their normal behavior. So as long as they're acting normal and don't mind, it's fine. As soon as they start like getting agitated or walk away, it's time for you to back off and get out of there. You can see this is where the whole Ross Sea, the permanent ice shelf, is being pushed northward by all the glaciers feeding it. And when it hits this peninsula, it forms these pressure ridges, these basically broken up chunks of ice, and that's where all the seals come popping up through, as those pressures. This is Willie Field on the permanent snow, and this is the permanent runway where all the stuff basically goes to the pole. Pegasus is the third runway, and what they've done is they've scraped down to the permanent ice and keep it snow-free so that they can bring in jet airplanes at the end of the season to offload. Because if they had to offload one of the turboprops, it would take too long. So that's, but it's so they have to be careful with it, otherwise they might ruin it.
Are those some kind of antenna towers there? All those.
A lot of antennas there. A lot of radio communication stuff. This is down on the, by the pressure ridges with Mount Erebus in the back. They get the good view of Mount Erebus. We can't see it from town. And they've got a flagged route for skiers, which I did. Skiing is one of the things that I really enjoyed there. Here's another shot of the pressure ridges at low sun. You can see some open water where the seals come through. They don't need very much space, and they come popping right up through this stuff. In fact, sometimes you saw seals, they're really funny. You see seals miles from anywhere, and they've come up through this little tiny hole that they've chewed up. And they can stay in the water for 80 minutes at a time. So they go 40 minutes out. If they can't find a breathing hole, then they come back to where they were. And they do a lot of seal studies here. There's a lot of diving physiology that's really interesting with the seals. In fact, one thing they did is they glued a videotape, video camera to the back of one of the seals because they didn't know what they were eating. And they actually videotape these seals going down and finding out what they're eating.
What do they eat?
They eat fish. Down low, they eat some of the benthic fish, but a lot of times they come up, there's fish that live up near the ice, just below the ice, and they'll blow bubbles to scare the fish and then nab the fish. And the video camera actually showed them doing it, and it was one of the new behaviors that they hadn't known about before. There's Mount Terror in the background, the one to the south or right of Mount Erebus. And one of the things we did, we got a lot of snow down there. I went from 500 inches of snowfall here to the biggest snowfall they've ever had down there. And you can see that nice dry powder. We went out in a sunny day. There's the end terminus of one of the glaciers coming down off of Hut Point Peninsula. There's looking up at Mount Erebus. And soon we got to the top of the hill and got this great view of everything you can see. This is actually snow school camp right here where we build snow shelters and we got our training. This is the road out to the permanent runway. And we started strapping on the boards and took off.
Do you have to watch your water intake and exposure to sun?
Excuse me, what? Oh.
Your own personal water intake or sun?
One of the things that they stress down there, because the air is so dry, is to drink. You're always drinking water with a water bottle, because every exhale is just getting rid of water out of your body. So you had to be real careful to not get dehydrated. Then it was my turn. This is the ski hill. Virgin powder. It was so wonderful. Yeah.
Telemark or just cross
country? Telemark. Yeah, cross country, telemark, backcountry. At the bottom of the hill, the Kiwis set up this old army truck and turned it into a rope tow. You can see, oh, I gotta point them out. See the nice car? Yeah. Anyway, so every now and then the Kiwis would come out and there's their Hagland in the background. The Hagland's actually the same company that made the old snow tracks that used to run here, those two Maximus and Minimus. They're the company that build those things. And they're a fiberglass shell, and the reason that they're so important, even though they're a couple hundred thousand dollars a piece, is that you can bust through the annual ice out on patrol or research, and they float. And you won't sink these things into the sea ice. And if the front end busts through, the back end has got treads that can pull you out. So anyway, they'd fire up the rope tow, and we'd all go down and put these belts around our waist with a little clamp that we'd clamp onto the rope. And you just throw it around the rope and just kind of let it pull you right on up the hill. And so there, that's me. Yeah, that's the goof we had coming down and it was a lot. Anyway, not only did they have the Hagland there, but they built the groomer. So they'd go up and groom the hill.
This is scientific research.
More or less. The weather down there was extremely unpredictable at times, which is why they always said go out and only go with another person. You had to go with at least one other person, and you had to check out at the fire station. If you got caught out alone, you were immediately shipped home. It was grounds. It was NBO.
Did you ever break that rule? Or?
Me? All the time. I couldn't find anyone to go skiing whenever I wanted to, and I finally discovered that other people did this regularly, and I discovered when the right times to go were, usually late in the evening. And so I was very discreet about just sort of sneaking out and getting out on the trail. But I also knew about, by that time I was used to the weather patterns and what you could get away with and what you had to watch out for. Anyway, right now these winds are going at about 50 miles an hour. You can see them drifting snow across. Snowdrift is the biggest depositor of snow on the Antarctic continent. At the South Pole, that's almost entirely what moves and builds up the snow. Occasionally, and for the first time, they have condition 3, condition 2, and condition 1. Condition 3 is normal open weather. 2 is visibility is down to a mile, a quarter mile. It's time to make sure you're close to home. Condition 1 is where visibility goes down to 100 feet or less. And this was what condition 1 started to look like. And it got, this is actually good. It got to where I couldn't even see this from the dormitory. And they strung up ropes between buildings. And basically, when condition 1 came, they said, you stay in your building and you just stay there. And that happened twice for the first time during any summer down there, which is interesting. So we got the highest snowfall and the biggest storms. It was great.
How much snowfall?
How much snowfall?
Yeah.
I forgot to ask them what the total snowfall for that summer was. But I know that it was, at least in terms of snowfall inches, it was over 50. Which is a lot down there.
Yeah.
This is the Willie Field from another angle, looking over towards Black Island. Excuse me, I'm sorry. This is the ice runway out on the annual ice. I'm sorry. And this is shortly after I got there. I took a trip to the South Pole for a week. I got to go to South Pole Station and work on their fire alarms, which is very, very nice. And not too many people got to do that. So we got down there and planes had come in from Christchurch on their skis. They'd land with the runway, taxi in. That was the emergency rescue vehicle there. They'd use the front end loaders to load in supplies in the rear end. And you can see the skis underneath. Then we'd take off. That gray one was a National Guard plane. These other ones were the VXC-6 Navy planes, and you can see. One of the reasons that more countries aren't doing research down there is because we won't give them the technology to put skis on their LC-130 transport planes. We sell the planes, but we don't sell the version that's beefed up for skis. Because the reason that all the superstructure inside is beefed up because the skis are a harder landing than wheels. So off we went to the South Pole in our little plane, all crowded in on these net seats. Looking back, you can see all the cargoes batten down, and we're all looking out the windows. And here's the cockpit. And what we did was we flied south along the Ross Ice with the Transantarctic Mountains on our right, and then they kind of curved around below us, and we went up the Beardmore and took Robert Scott's route. Right here is the Beardmore Glacier. We took the Beardmore up to South Pole Station. So looking down, and these glaciers were just incredible. It was one of the most incredible experiences of my whole life, looking down on this, what looked like another planet. And on my way back, I ran out of film at South Pole. On the way back, the plane was empty, and the guy says, "Oh, by the way, we have this special photographic window that we're going to open up so you can get a great view." This perfectly flat, clear window looking at the greatest glaciers of my life, and I had run out of film.
Oh.
Yeah, I was crying, but I stayed glued to that for 2 hours on the way back. And for some reason, the other four people just sacked out. I thought, how many times do you fly to the South Pole? These people are zonked up. Anyway, coming up pretty soon. Yeah, there. Now we're hitting the plateau. The mountains are getting covered. This is where all the plateau ice spills through the mountains down to the ice. And we land at South Pole Station. And even South Pole Station has its own airport. PAX is for passenger.
Oh.
It's actually a peace terminal, right? But this is the terminal, and you can see the dome. Many of you have seen the familiar South Pole dome that houses the winter quarters, Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. You can see the airplanes come in over here. This is an Otter. They taxi in around here to the terminal and taxi back out. And the actual South Pole is right there. This is the actual where the pole is. What they did is they tried to plan it because the ice is moving. And it's moving this way. They're planning it so that the pole, the actual geographic pole, would end up at South Pole Station in the year 2000. And they ended up a little bit short. It moves about 12 feet a year. So, and they have all these poles lined up that you can see from poles from the recent past.
Why does it move it? I don't understand.
You're sitting on a 10,000 feet of glacial ice.
Oh, it's all moving.
This is on top of a continent, and gravity is literally pulling it down away from the center. So, and one of the reasons everything has to be unburied constantly, because the wind is drifting snow, and any obstruction gets drifted in. One of the things they're doing is they're building a new South Pole Station, and that's what these arches are all about. This area down here is all supply facilities. This is where everybody lives. The summer people live. The winter people all live under here. This is what's called the garage arch. You have the garage, the power plant, and then this thing continues on over here, but it's all buried. This is where all the fuel bladders are. This is the old fresh, clean air facility. South Pole Station is home of the major clean air atmospheric research. Now we're looking back. That last picture was taken from this tower up here. And the clean air facility is out here. There's a wedge that goes out from the clean air facility that nobody can go into. And it's the upwind portion. So all the prevailing winds come through that into the building where they take the cleanest samples of air in the world, and they're shipped out as standards to base research on. It's the air standard to base pollution research on. Some of the other work they do down here is, well, first of all, I'm on the balloon building, so they do a lot of balloon launches to do more atmospheric research. I'm looking towards the station. What I'm going to be doing is panning around to the left. There's the garage arch there, going north. Back up. Right here, you can see there's the geographic South Pole. Here's the ceremonial pole, which we'll get back to later.
Hey,
yeah?
While you were there, do they leave the engines running on the plane? Or
all the time. If they stop the engines, they have a hard time starting them. When it's colder, if they can't even land at 54 below or lower, because if they land, when they idle the turboprops down, the hydraulic oil that goes into the variable pitch blades starts leaking like a sieve because all the seals shrink up. Whereas when they're up to speed, like up in the atmosphere, it's a lot colder than that, but when they're up to speed, they won't leak.
So are winter people there without any means of getting out?
Absolutely. From February 1st is the last flight out of the pole. February 11th is the last flight from the pole. From then till November 11th. That's it. There's no in and out. You have a problem there, you're stuck.
They have medical facilities?
Yeah, they have in fact, the doctor down there was a great fiddle player. We played fiddle teams. You can see this is the summer camp down there. These are called James Way huts. They're little Quonset hut style things that can be put up and broken down. And then this is looking due south to the, those arches will be put back in place for more storage. They're going to build a whole new station down there, and that's so. Right now, South Pole is just full of activity during the summer. They've cleared a lot of snow out for the buildings, and there's a lot of construction going on. Back to research, they do the Clean Air Facility, run by NOAA, National Oceanographic Administration, does a lot of air, atmospheric pollution studies. They're also doing global climate studies, looking at temperature stuff, and there's drilling facilities down there that they're taking ice cores, and they'll take the ice core and actually go in and look at trace gases and stuff within the ice to figure out what the climate was in the geologic past to see what the patterns are. They do astronomy studies down there. They've got various telescopes that they can do research because it's the thinnest spot in the atmosphere. The thinnest, cleanest part of the atmosphere is down there. So they can get away with a lot of studies that they can't do anywhere else. One of the prime directives of National Science Foundation for research down there is you have to show that the research you're doing can't be done anywhere else because it's extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. So in order to get a grant, it has to be, this is the only place you can do it.
Then go through that organization?
Absolutely. They go through the National Science Foundation and get grants. And other countries can do that.
Is that a private organization?
No, National Science Foundation is the government agency. This is the inside of the dome, looking over at the science building, actually. But you can see, even inside here, it's only about 10 degrees. Mm-hmm. And when you get out of the buildings, this is warm compared to the outside. But this is the garage arch, looking at the doors to the garage. This is the generator plant. This is the ceremonial pole, and you can see it's butt ugly cold, and I'm all wrapped up in goggles and everything. And but there was a time when I had to show, it's not that cold down here. And then after you took this picture, I ran over and put my parka on, and I was freezing.
Do you have trouble with your camera?
No, actually I didn't. I had good luck with it. One of the other scientific projects that you were asking about, the Cape Roberts project, was a drilling project where they went out to the sea ice just offshore and north. On the map, it would be Cape Roberts is right here. So they were sitting right out here on about it used to be 6 or 8 feet of ice, doing these core samples, because what they want to do is core the offshore offshore rock to find out what happened in the geologic past in terms of glaciations. What they want to do is try and nail the last, the most recent major glaciation down there and relate that to climate and global warming, among other things. So that's the picture of the drilling rig. And they did, the scientists were incredible down there. They'd do these special open houses. Every Sunday they did a lecture for the lay people, and the place was packed. All these tradespeople and roughnecks and inventors, they'd all get in there and they were interested. And then Wednesday they'd do the scientific lecture for the fellow scientists. But you can see what they did is these sediments are all tilted up. So instead of having to drill through all of them, all they had to do was drill through these right here, go this far, and you'd get that many years. You go here and you drill this far and you get the next set of years. You go over here and drill this far and you get the next set of years, and then you'd get a record from here all the way up to here of all these different rock layers. And this is the geophysical soundings that they did to get the structure of the rock. But I better whip through this. This is just their rough estimate of what was going on in terms. Those symbols refer to grain sizes, type of rock grains, biological species that they found in, usually little foraminifera and diatoms. And this is the actual core. And the core is not really rock. It's almost a compact mud that fell apart very easily. But they showed us the actual core that they were taking samples of and what they were doing. How they were writing it all out, and each scientist had a specific perspective on the core and took a little piece of it to study, and they all had, this was a X-ray spectroscopy that they did on the core, and they showed the picture of what was happening. Let us look in all these microscopes. This guy was an Italian petrographer who specialized in volcanic hard rock geology. He was really, really interesting. Stuff. Then there's the balloon launch, which people came from miles around. And we set up the bleachers here on this delta. And they have this gondola, $2 million gondola with atmospheric, astronomical, all kinds of research going on. Everybody, it's like the shuttle. All the scientists have their own little experiment package on there. And they strung it all out. And on the left-hand end, you had the helium over here, and the balloon was laid out by that reel. So they started filling the balloon, and then it was held down by that trip mechanism over there. They wouldn't let it get too big, as you can see, and then they tripped it, and it was a flawless launch. You can see this right here is a parachute, and as it went up in the atmosphere, the air pressure gets less and less, and this thing starts to expand until it's from here all the way around like that. And then once they did the research, they tripped a mechanism, and it had dropped the parachute, and it had parachuted back down to the ground. Once it hit the ground, the parachute releases, and they go down and fly out and pick up the gondola. Wow. However, this balloon went up to, I can't remember what it was like 4 or 5 miles up in the air, and it hits the circumpolar winds, which go around the continent. So what it does, it goes up there, and for 13 days it goes around the continent and comes right back about where it started, and they drop it so that they can go out and get it. Unfortunately, the balloon sprung a leak, and it came down to a level that was going to take it out to sea, and they had to drop it prematurely. And then the parachute didn't release from the ground, and it drug it along the ground. So there's 2 million gondolas hitting the sastrugi, bouncing along, and they're all going, oh my God. Another research was on fish antifreezes. These are 4 foot long Antarctic cod in the old aquarium that they had. I went down there quite often to check on fire alarm stuff. You can see, he's a cute bugger. He's 4 feet long. You go out and pet him and say hi. And but what they did was they'd go out onto the ice, drill holes, put up a fishing shack, and they'd reel these buggers in and put them in a tank and bring them in for research. And apparently, the ocean down there is 28 degrees. I mean, it's salt water. Salt water freezes a lot colder than fresh water. And these fish need to figure out a way to keep their bodies from turning to ice cubes. And so they've got literally glycols, similar to the ethylene and propylene glycol we use for antifreeze, and these glycols running through their bloodstream, which as the ice molecule forms, they gather around it and keep it from forming into a bigger crystal. So you've got these ice crystals forming and breaking apart and forming all the time. If it weren't for those glycols, what they found is they can introduce a small ice crystal into the fish and they freeze very quickly because there's a growth medium for the ice to start growing. Once it starts growing, then they're dead in the water. This piece of equipment, 6 years ago, I was working as an electrical apprentice back in Hanover, New Hampshire, at the Cold Regions Research Facility. And they were building this thing on an old Bobcat machine to go down to the South Pole, and they used it to bore into the snow down at South Pole to create this big vault underneath the ice of the glacier to put all their sewage in. So they bore it out with this machine and send the snow back out the hole it went in and created the sewage, what do they call it?
Storage?
Well, yeah, basically this big cave underneath where they dumped all their raw sewage. But so back then I was thinking, wow, what a crazy machine. And then here it is, 6 years later, I find there it is down at the pole. So I had to get a picture of it. One of the trips I took was out to Black Island. Remember I told you about White Island and Black Island? I got a chance to go out there. And of course, once you go to Black Island, it always storms, and then you don't get off of there for days, and that's exactly what happened to me. We got there. I was supposed to go out this same afternoon after I did my work, and it stormed, and the visibility went down, and they didn't get a helicopter back for 3 days. But this is the main satellite communications facility, all wind and solar powered, big banks of batteries. And they do have generator backup, but they really only fired them up to test them. That dome right there had a big dish antenna. There are two of those. One is aimed at McMurdo, and the other is aimed up at the satellite. But that's where we would, there were, 19 telecommunication lines for data transfer and telephones. We had 10 lines available to anybody on the station just to call home. And they all downloaded through ComSat in Brewster, Washington. So my phone call to Okanagan to my parents was almost a local call because they tolled it out from there. So that was kind of interesting. But anyway, I got, as a result, that was my helper. As a result of getting stuck there for 3 days, I got to hike without having to check out, without having to worry about getting, it was a lot looser. I felt free out here. You took a radio and you just kept checking in. And they said, all right, take off. Here's a radio. But I got a chance to look at this is one of the frozen lakes. And that's one of the lakes that melted. Here we are, middle of Antarctica. There's a lake. There are algae down there. This is where they'd go down there and fill up their tanks for fresh water for this particular station. A lot of more antenna stuff, and there's Mount Discovery in the background again. What was interesting is we flew in, and you can almost see it here, as you flew into this is all morainal debris, which you can tell just by looking at the rock, because there's volcanic rock, there's intrusive rock, there's sedimentary rock. It's all a jumble of different sizes. But it's like up in the Arctic, if you look at the tundra and the permafrost, when the permafrost freezes, it expands, but when it warms up, it contracts. And when it contracts, it forms these polygonal pattern cracks. And if you look at it from the top, it's just all these polygons surrounded by cracks. And you go up to these cracks and you look at them, And they go down really far, and it's pretty obvious you've got ice wedging happening there, freeze-thaw activity, moving these cracks apart, and I thought, wow, like, you know, you're seeing it here as well as up in the tundra. What I really thought was, boy, my bachelor's in geology actually came in handy. But that's out in that's the ocean, and you can see the morainal debris being pushed out from the glaciers out onto the permanent ice of Ross Sea. This is looking back, this is actually looking up north towards Marble Point, but more dirty ice from the glaciers. Another one. That's Mount Aurora, which is the highest point on Black Island. And another shot of the radar domes and such.
Why do we call it dirty ice?
I'm just calling it dirty ice because it's morainal debris. It's gravelly, broken up rock from the glaciers that's made it out to the terminus. Coming back in the helicopter, there's a good shot of McMurdo and Castle Rock, which was one of the few loops you could do, is you could go out up this road here, and then there's a flag trail out to Castle Rock, and then you go back down the ski hill to the Ross Ice Shelf, back via Scott Base, and then come back between Odd Hill and the base. There's a picture you can see the Nathaniel B. Palmer in the background and the VXC-6 Navy warehouses there. And it was still kind of storming. Okay, there's Mount Erebus clouded in the background and Castle Rock. And I'm going to take you on that loop ski trip that was one of my favorites that I did alone a number of times. It was a 7-mile loop, one of the emergency shelters. We called them tomatoes. They used to call them apples. Nice shot of Erebus. And then Castle Rock with another emergency shelter.
Are those emergency shelters just like out there for people who might need them?
Oh yeah, I mean it's like when the whiteouts start coming and you can't get back, you want to be in here. I mean they're used. But you can see how the trails are flagged. This is climbing up Castle Rock. You can see it's a volcanic neck. All these volcanic cinders cemented together in there. There's another close-up. It's mostly basaltic. Looking out towards Mount Discovery. And this is, you can see this is after one of the fresh snows. And then the top. You gotta get the summit shot, of course. This is looking back down towards the Ross Sea and McMurdo. This is looking, same shot, you can actually see faintly the trail and Mount Discovery and the radar dome up on Arrival Heights. This is looking, now I'm panning around to the left. There's Scott Base right here, and you can see it's starting to get soft and melt. There's White Island and Black Island, Minna Bluffs back there.
Has there been any volcanic activity down there in the last 100 years or so?
Absolutely. Funny you should ask. I guess it's the next shot. You'll see Erebus is actually smoking. And they go helicopter up. There's a field camp up there where they study the crater and what's happening up there. This is the Ross Sea right here coming in to the base of Mount Erebus. Panning to the left. There's Turtle Rock. You can start to see the area of Erebus Ice Tongue. There's what it looks like earlier on in the year where it's all frozen over. This is the same or a similar shot backed up a little more. You can see the same islands all out here where the ice has come back. And here's the Erebus Ice Tongue, which extends all the way out here. It's a glacier that's floating out here. And earlier in the year, we'd take a trip this way, go along the ice tongue, and go into the crevasses, which formed ice caves. You could get at them from the side, which are really cool. There's the Erebus smoking. You can see the smoke coming out of the top. Now I'm on the other side of Castle Rock, coming down. You can see the sastrugi, which is the wind-blown snow, how the wind carves these things. And these Belgians did a transarctic trek with just the two of them, unsupported. They started at one end, went to the other, ended up at McMurdo. I got a chance to talk with them, and they had some incredible adventures, but I need to keep moving, otherwise I'd tell you about them. But this is the kind of stuff that they'd go over and take, oh man. They used these parafoils, to pull them along, which is one of the things that they pioneered, was the use of these literally kites that pull them up to 35 miles an hour under good conditions.
That's what you call sailing.
Yeah.
On skis then?
They had skis, yeah. Really neat skis. In fact, they had some with full skins and some with half skins, and the half skins were actually built into the skis so that they wouldn't have any problems with them. All right, things get on towards December, and they melt out. I think I can whip this through in 5 minutes if you want to bear with me. And the wind is actually blowing the drips in one direction, so you get these curved icicles. Those are the skuas, which are related to gulls. Some of the skuas first showed up in November. Christmas time, we put up the Christmas decorations, of course. Actually, do people want to come back after Vespers? You want me to try and finish this up real quick? Because I don't know that I'm going to be able to finish it before Vespers.
Is there a
form?
Oh, yeah, okay, so we'll whip through them. All right. Hey, Mom, I painted this for we did all of these big Christmas things, and I did that. This is the inside of the heavy shop where we had our Christmas party. Lots of parties happening there. This is one of the... This is the margarita dispenser that we built. Fingies were the friggin' new guys. It was an acronym for... It was actually a different word, but... But anyway, the new people, and this was our donation to the, you know, that marked our year of new people down there. And iStock took place New Year's Day. We had 7 live bands down there, which was incredible. And each one of them did a show here. We even had the didgeridoos, and it was cold, by the way. That guy, even though he was rolling in the mud. And I even got a chance to play and did some bluegrass, but even though this doesn't show it, it was just a full day of outdoor dancing and barbecue and hacky sack and good times, and it was really when things picked up. Then we had the McMurdo Playhouse where we did the plays. That was a friend of mine, Sue. We went to the play together. And then after the plays, we decided to do another party in here with all the bands playing. This is their kind of farewell concert. Great dances. Gatherings in the lounge were wonderful. Then the penguins came. And these are the Adelie penguins. They came down. They'd scoot along in their bellies a lot, as well as walking. And then they got to this point by our intake, and they started preening and getting ready. Hi there. Yeah. And they had the headless penguins, too. This is a rare variety that I decided to catch. And this is some of the immature first-year penguins that were molting, and they got really miserable when they molted. They just sat here for weeks getting rid of their feathers. And there they are, just kind of going, and they go, but anyway, there's feathers all over the place. And then the Polar Star came in. This is the first shot of the icebreaker coming in to break a way in. These penguins made their way to the heliport and actually slept under the helicopters. They're incredibly curious. They'll walk right up to you and shake hands. I mean, so the ship started coming in, and they, I could tell you a lot about the icebreaker, but we got to keep moving. And pretty soon you'd have an inlet where the tankers would come in. The tanker would unload fuel, millions and millions of gallons of fuel. And they went, I really hated the way they wasted fuel down there. That was one of my big bones to pick with them. It was bad. And I had to suck in a lot, keep from. Anyway, I was on the crew that helped cast this one off. You can see the dorms. They threw a rope over here and they towed it out to sea like that, and then got it away from the pier. That pier, by the way, is a big chunk of ice, 30 feet thick, covered with gravel, so that they could bring the ships up close without touching bottom. Mm. Then the container ship came in with all the supplies for a year, offloaded the container ship, and the containers stacked up. All right, And, yeah, they were called the Green Wave. Then then the Nathaniel B. Palmer came in, state-of-the-art research vessel that did a lot of stuff. It's an icebreaker in its own right. And in fact, ASA, you can get on with ASA to work on this ship if you want. And Discovery Hut. Inside of the hut looks like this, and these are the things left just the way we found them. Don't worry, we're just missing the announcements and new people. And I'll be done. That's mutton that was hung up. Sheep carcasses. All right, then we got to go out on the Polar Star for a cruise, and they took all of us out to the ice edge. I was looking back at town, and they showed us how the icebreaker would go through and break through this ice, which was really nothing. This icebreaker could break through 20 feet of ice.
Oh, wow. God.
And the way it does is that it pushes itself up on top of the ice and then lets the weight of the icebreaker break the ice. It doesn't ram it. And we saw killer whales and lots of killer whales all cruising the ice because they were looking for these guys, the little penguins. And they saw us and they started scooting away on their bellies. And the skuas. And then here comes the X-rated part. The polar plunge. Yes, we did jump into the sea. It was my turn, and this is just to prove that, yes, indeed, I went swimming. Get me out of here. The rope actually slipped down to my legs, and I finally kicked it off so I could get up. And then we're just going to kind of whip right by this one. That was my roommate. He was the first one in. The sun slowly sinking in the west, and I actually saw the green flash for the first time because it got down to where it would refract green instead of red. And the minke whales would swim right by Hut Point Peninsula. We'd hear them breathing. It was really neat. And that's what it looked pretty much the end of the year, the open ice, sun sinking in the west, and then it was time to leave. My last parting shots of Antarctica. And a goodbye to the, got back to the CDC, where we gave all of our gear back, and they'd stuff it up and sort it and wash it for the next year. And this is what the winter folk had to look forward to, was the dark coming and the full moon and everything else. And that's the last shot, so if you have any questions... Talk to me later. I have all of this stuff available.